Hey everyone, just want to let you know, if you haven't yet checked out The Miracle Moment, you can go over to NicoleEunice.com/miraclemoment to get a little feel for the book coming out in May. Going to have a lot more to say about it, but already have had such an encouraging season of getting to share some of the practical tools behind really healthy relationships in our entire life. So looking forward to that. Go check it out. Share it with your friends. Join me on socials. And if you guys are enjoying this podcast and you have time, or you could find time to write a review, that would be amazing, because we have really cool guests coming up and I just want as many people as possible to get to connect with this content and all of these incredible people who've been joining me on the show. Thanks, you guys. You're the real MVPs.
Unchecked power in humans almost always goes badly, whether or not they started as a narcissist.
Right, exactly. And research supports this.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Let's Be Real podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Eunice, and I believe we need all the help we can get when it comes to living a full and free life. Here you'll find honest truth, practical tips, and perspective changes that help you embrace the miracle that is your life. It's an in-process conversation that's going to be unfiltered, and it better be fun. Let's get real together.
All right, you guys, welcome to Let's Be Real. I am so excited to introduce you to my new friend, Tiffany Bloom. We have had some mutual connections that we've just discovered over the past few minutes as we've gotten ready for this episode. And I am really excited because Tiffany is a podcaster, an author, I would call you a thought leader. Is that like something you've been dying to be called?
I will receive that. It's adding to my resume, to my Twitter bio. It's going on there immediately. Thought leader.
How do you become a thought leader? Well, I just like raced through your book. It was so good. And as I was reading it, without really knowing as much about you, and I haven't read your previous work. So as I was reading it, I'm like, gosh, like Tiffany has she's like doing a really thoughtful engagement on like broader issues. And it was refreshing. So I really enjoyed just having, I felt like you just brought, like, are you a journalism major? I felt like you brought a ton of kind of the ability to tell a great story through like content. Is that you, or am I just making that up?
Yeah, no, you're hitting the nail on the head. First of all, let's go back to the thought leader. If Shia LaBeouf can be a tastemaker, I can be a thought leader. And I really wanted to take a journalistic approach to this book, because I think when we're talking about women's equality and imbalance of power between men and women, you need some solid case studies, and personal narrative is great. But I wanted there to be stories that everybody already knew, everybody's already heard, and give a fresh angle on them. We all have heard about Monica Lewinsky. She's in over 100 rap songs. You know, we all know about, you know, John Chris and Andy Savage and Bill Hybels and all these stories that we've heard about imbalance of power at a woman's expense. But I wanted to try to give a view and understanding and take on it to help paint a broader picture.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book's called Pray Tell: Why We Silence Women Who Tell the Truth and How Everyone Can Speak Up. And obviously, like, we've been through the Me Too movement, like there's a lot of just more conversation around this concept, but I know that you particularly are teasing out this concept of power. And I just want to ask, like, as we jump into this content and then get to know you a little bit, like, why this book and why now? Why was now the right time for it?
Why this book? I think just lived experience, as you can probably imagine, of speaking truth to power and finding that things didn't bend my way when they very much should have, when I was a truth teller and I had a great track record of honesty, and then to entrust sensitive matters to people who you thought would do the right thing and then didn't was a jarring experience. And I think so many of us are like, hey, I played by the rules. Come on, hold up your end of the deal. Hold up your end of the deal of being honest and ensuring that we have safe, equitable spaces for everyone. And then secondly, I would say, why now? To be honest, I actually wanted to write a book. Hopefully nobody steals this title. Don't steal this title, listeners. I wanted to write a book called The Resisterhood and talk about what does it look like to see women of color and white women really come together, this, you know, third wave feminism that we're learning about, an intersectional lens, what does it look like in Christian culture? And the more I wrote, okay, I realized like, wait, I have something else to say first. I want to talk about, really, this book is more about men than women. It's more about what happens and why do we let men get away with so much and have so few consequences. So it really has become fitting. And honestly, it was a conversation with my agent. She's like, I think we have a different idea that's forming here. And I was like, let's do this. Let's really walk this out and do the dang thing. And I'm a 3 on the Enneagram like yourself, Nicole, but I wouldn't consider myself this like charge the hill. An 8's like to charge hills. I'm like, hey, let's all be agreeable, diplomatic. Let's all get along, glass half full. Everybody's awesome. And so to talk and wade into such controversial waters was not something I would have penned myself as doing, but here we are. And I really believe it matters.
Absolutely.
It matters.
Well, I mean, you've said like so many things that are amazing that I just want to circle back to catch our listeners up. The first is that you said, okay, this is my lived experience. So can you just give us a little snapshot of who you are, and without really going into any details, just kind of like why this story and this, just for those of you guys who know, since you haven't read the book yet, but you should, Tiffany's going to weave her personal experiences together with the experiences of many, many others. And I think that does give you this broader, like, hey, this is something we have to pay attention to. So can you just give our listeners a little bit so they know some about who you are?
Yeah. So I'm Indian. I was adopted just shy of my second birthday. And I grew up in a rural white community. So I was this token brown girl growing up in a sea of snow white, and really trying to contort myself to fit into majority culture, to be accepted. I can sound like you. I can wear the Doc Martens like you. I can do all the NSYNC dances like you and listen to New Kids on the Block like you. I can do everything to be accepted by you. And that really translated into education, into my faith experience. And so growing up, I realized, okay, if I can meet these benchmarks and be acceptable, and I think women in general have these benchmarks, women of color have a little bit more nuanced understanding of this, then things can move, you know, the train can move down the track and everybody can get along if I play by your rules. And so here I was in adulthood, playing by the rules, doing everything I was told to do. And so when I found myself with sensitive information and spoke truth to power, I lost more in the process than I would have ever thought possible. I was seen as disposable, Nicole. And this man who abused his power at a woman's expense was seen as indispensable. So as I grappled with why I was not believed, once I finally was able to pick my loyalty to my convictions over my loyalty to an institution, I really grappled with why we silence women and the societal, financial, professional, and spiritual ramifications for doing so. And as I uncovered this prevalent phenomena that you see in every sector of society, I discovered that we are all complicit in systems. I don't care where you work, what you do, entertainment, business, education, politics, the church, wherever. There are systems architected to enable men's behavior, and their systems architected to subjugate, silence, and slander women's behavior, misbehavior, and to really cover up when there's been that imbalance of power. And we know there's several power dynamics at play. There's race, there's class, there's physical size, and there's platform. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to take into account when you think about this. And so living through it, and then later in my personal situation, when it hit the fan a few years later after I came forward, this person was removed from power. And there was a trail of broken lives in the process. And I think back, okay, it stinks to be the first one to speak up. And we often wait, you know, scripturally, we wait for 2 or 3 more witnesses, and really we're waiting for 2 or 3 more victims. We wait for so many people to be harmed before we will question a man's account. We hold his accolades above accusations.
So tell me about, let's like take me back to that moment, because I think there's like a really twisted thing that happens in people's lives when it comes to experiences like this. I think the twisted thing is that somehow we believe if we're good enough or we can be different, that somehow there's a fault in whoever that victim is that has created that dynamic that then plays out. And then if you find yourself the good girl, the follow the rules, the Enneagram 3, I can do it all, you know, in that position, take us back to that time where I'm assuming you were really grieving and sort of figuring out what and how you were supposed to use your voice. What gave you the courage to speak up in the first place?
Yeah. Well before I did a lot of things wrong. I stayed silent for mm-hmm. years and years amidst coarse joking, amidst slander and manipulation and gaslighting, because I didn't see how my speaking up as just one person could really make a difference. And I think that's something we all do. We're like, mm-hmm. not my circus, not my monkeys. I really can't make a difference here. Why waste my breath when in reality, I would have so much to lose if I were to speak up? The gatekeeper who let me in here would not be pleased if I speak up against him. He'd not be pleased and I'd lose resources. I would lose proximity to power. So I think we have to go through this wrestle of understanding what we would lose in the system. And once we do that, we can really think, okay, what this is the exterior of things to lose, but interior, what's my role? This is an ethical issue we really have to all ask ourselves. What's my role to speak up, even if this didn't happen to me? Because 90% of us are the bystander. 90% of us are watching like, oh man, what am I supposed to do here? And so for me, it was when someone else lent their strength, as I lent my strength to a victim of misconduct, and together really having a collective voice, being able to be like, okay, I can do this. I can go first because I know these people have my back and I know these people are going to walk with me and pray with me and be available. So really it was knowing that I can do this because others are lending my strength, lending me their strength. And it really was the game changer, to be completely honest with you, when I finally was like, hey, I can speak up. I can go first. And so many more people spoke up after me. And you see that, let's take Harvey Weinstein, for example, or R. Kelly. Mm. It took Ashley Judd going first and put on paper in the New York Times before dozens upon dozens of other women would come forward. Somebody's got to go first.
Yeah. What is it, you know, when you're in that, obviously you're doing a retrospect, you're looking back at an experience you had, which obviously in my work as like a therapist, oftentimes we will deconstruct a failed relationship, deconstruct like what brought a divorce on. And there usually is all of these signposts along the way that maybe were like in hindsight, like, why didn't I do something? For anyone listening right now, just to like jump into a super practical point, for anyone listening right now who's like, I get a vibe, but you know what I mean? The coarse joking, the manipulation, like I have a vibe and I don't know what to do with it. Kind of, how would you instruct that person? Let's say they're in an organization right now where they're seeing some of that. And like you said, it's easy to just be like, well, I'm a bystander. Like I'm not, you know, what is the move at that point?
Yes. Oh, what a great question. Because long before we read something on CNN or RNS or Christianity Today, there's these opportunities to step in where there isn't much to lose, where there isn't much on the table, where we don't have to think, I'm going to lose everything and my 401k because I'm going to speak up. And it's aptly called bystander intervention. And so when you see an imbalance of power between a man and a woman, when you see some coarse joking, or when you see some body language that doesn't look quite right between Rosie and Doug, you know, and you sense that Doug's tone is, I'm like, nobody has fallen from grace who's named Doug in the last year. I hope they feel bad.
I'm not trying to. I wish you guys could see Tiffany. I know. I want all my listeners to be able to see you because Tiffany's eyes literally went right and left like four times. Like she was like, let me find a name that hasn't been in the news in like the last year. Poor Doug. Okay. So our guy's Doug, right?
Doug. And okay. But
in this scenario,
yeah, Doug is using.
Go ahead, paint the picture.
Yeah, Doug is using a bit of an intense tone. Doug has his hand on Rosie's shoulder, and you sense that there's something's not quite right. Easy peasy. You walk in. Hey, Rosie, did you want to just go grab a coffee? Oh, Rosie, I needed to go to the copier. I had something to fill you in on. Did you want to walk with me? Before anything gets crazy, we can do these small actions when we can keep our eyes open, and then after interrupting. And just changing the subject, we can then maybe hours, days later, go to Doug and say, Doug, hey, Doug, I don't think you realized how you came across to Rosie. I sensed that she felt a little uncomfortable. Doug's like, what are you talking about? Yeah, I could tell she was uncomfortable. So you've already made yourself an ally. Doug knows he's been seen. And then thirdly, you go to this woman and say, are you okay? I noticed the way Doug was talking to you. It didn't seem quite right. Again, before this blows up, And there might have been something that Doug already did and we didn't know. And she now feels seen. She now feels heard.
Yeah. What if she denies?
What if she denies?
Because if you're, well, yeah, because if when you're deeply in proximity to power, like we've talked about, like you talk about, when you fear, right, like you're in that complying place where you're sort of rationalizing away some things that you might be experiencing personally. What have you ever been in that experience?
What a great question. I think
with
in those
woman
moments,
who denies.
Yes, many times. And I think in that moment you offer, you offer yourself, hey, if something ever goes south with that, just know you can come to me. We can talk this. I'll go to HR with you. I'll go to the elder board with you. I'll go to whoever. Hey, I'm here for you. Make yourself available because there is going to come a time when that rationalization won't hold its legs under it anymore. And she's now noticed, somebody else already noticed this and I don't have to go explain. So being available later is more powerful than we could even imagine. In fact, this is so effective, bystander intervention. The military, all branches of the military have employed this to ensure that everyone sees themselves as a responsible party ethically to address misconduct because it is so rampant in the military. Hospitals use this. Large universities are starting to employ this. So this is something, again, so small, but it makes everybody responsible, this collective care for one another versus this individualist, hey, that's not my problem. This guy did this to you. You can go talk to, you know, the dean and figure it out, but I'm not dealing with this. But no, we all have some skin in the game.
Absolutely. And in the book you talk about pretty early on and at the end of my book coming out in May, I have a chapter like when it doesn't get better, which really starts to address like yellow light, red light issues in people. And you talk pretty early in your book about narcissism, about that concept. Why do you think narcissism is so prevalent in these structures? And what do we do when, like, I think kind of like, let's use Doug as an example, because one of the things that you and I both know, or Doug, I know, Doug, I'm so sorry, but you need help. One of the things that you and I both know is like, if you're not sure about Doug, you will be sure if you start paying attention because the pattern will be prevalent. It's not like a one time, like Doug was brushing, you know, a piece of something off of Rosie's shoulder.
Right.
If that happened, you wouldn't be worried about Doug in the first place. You wouldn't be noticing Doug in the first place if that's what it was, because the pattern is prevalent. So talk to me a little bit about what you've discovered about kind of narcissism or narcissistic tendencies and power.
Yeah, absolutely. Narcissism, first of all, is praised. We hold it up as a holy view of leadership in nearly every sector of society. And often those with fruit in their work, whether it's success or ministry, wherever the case may be, those values that they held dear to even get to a place of power, they often shed on the way there. And those narcissistic tendencies are valued, they're praised, and they're seen as almost a prerequisite for leadership. And we'd love to think that somebody with, you know, too many selfies is narcissistic, but in reality, narcissistic tendencies can show up in a multitude of ways. Number one, you often see it as very charming. Masters of first impression. They will quickly find out what's of value to you, who's of value to you, what you're looking to accomplish in life. And they're expert manipulators. They're expert manipulators in twisting the narrative and gaslighting a story where they come out on top. There's always going to be an imbalance of power for a narcissist because you are supply. You are a product to be consumed for their agenda. And again, when you're in leadership, it is so easy, Nicole, to groom the people around you to meet that need. Why? Because you're the boss and they sign your paycheck. And you sign their paycheck and you have all the power in the world. So working late for your boss, and you're thinking, no, I'm just doing this for the organization. I'm here to help move things along. And in reality, you're being taken advantage of. And again, you're being tested to see what you can handle. And when you're no longer of value to a narcissist, you're discarded. But if you do try to worm your way back in, and because then you feel guilty and you've been manipulated to believe that you've done something wrong, you will be love bombed. And love bombed is this practice where a narcissist will employ, he doesn't have to really do any reconnaissance work anymore because he knows what you value and he can offer the resources, opportunity, platform, prestige, finances, whatever the case, whatever the case you need is. And we can practice when we're with a narcissist person, euphoric recall, where we'll only remember the good parts. We'll only remember the kindness and the generosity and the benevolence that we've received. And we will not be able to see in whole in the picture. Why? Because we believe a narcissist's retelling of events, not our own, which is why there has to be more accountability in every leadership level on planet Earth. Because when this narcissistic tendencies go unchecked and there's not accountability and there's not a broader understanding of what's going on, this goes unchecked.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that one question I've often answered is, does a narcissist know what they're doing? And is it intentional? And the answer is sometimes, but not always, truly. Like that does not remove the accountability to behavior, but they want to know, like, is this person, because I think what I'm hearing is this person that I love and respect a mastermind who is intentionally and evilly manipulating? And I would say actually a narcissist is a very broken person who has got a deep, deep wounding that you will not be able to fix.
Correct.
Some of them do know they're doing it. Some of them do not know that they're manipulating and they're gaslighting and they're changing the narrative and they're doing all the things that you're naming. That in no way changes the way we interact and engage. But to me, it does say something about, and this is like a much like bigger thing, but like, it does say something to me about humans in power and what happens.
Come on.
Like, no matter who you are, like,
that's right.
There is something about the human capacity to handle power. And yet we hand power sort of unilaterally to people without, like you said, Tiffany, I think we're really getting at, like, what does it look like to not be silenced, to have accountability, to be mutually responsible for one another? Because an unchecked power in humans almost always goes badly. And it, whether or not they started as a narcissist, does that make
right.
sense? Like,
exactly. And research supports this. Research shows that men who have more access to power and a platform believe themselves to be more sexually attractive, desirable, and will seek out sexual affairs, even if they're non-consensual.
That is fascinating. And also, I'm like, it makes so much sense because oftentimes you read in the news about these people that you've admired, about you, and you're like, why would they do that? Like, that is so dumb. Like, it just,
why would they,
you know, but I mean, when you're right, exactly, exactly. So research supports that that's one of those supplies. Is that sort of what
they truly believe that they are sexually desirable and that they need to be gratified and they deserve to be gratified?
Gosh, it's such a sad state of affairs on both sides. Again, like, just in the spirit of like people who are hurt, who hurt other people. But when the power is as it is, like we're talking about, Tiffany, when that power differential exists, that is everything. That is everything, is that what happens when that power is different. So why is silence so often the response to misconduct when it is in this power differential of any kind?
Because it's costly to speak up. Silence demands nothing of you. Speaking up demands, it could demand everything of you. And silence starts very young. You know, there's research that shows that as early as 24 months, children who have been harmed will cover up for their parents because this is the way things are. And so we've started silence at such a young age, especially for women, especially for young girls. On the playground, they'll be silenced. They'll be bullied. They'll be made fun of by other girls. So we self-silence and even at the hands of our own parents who, and culturally, you know, in more, in particular cultures, there is more of an expectation to be silent. And you see this, it plays out in stereotypes of East Asian women, of South Asian women. We expect you to be silent. We expect you to understand that this is the way things are and you are something to be had and consumed. And so it really starts young. And then you move into middle school years where it's very difficult to find a middle school girl who hasn't been harassed or assaulted. It's very, very difficult. Over 60% have likely been harassed or assaulted. And why? Because boys consider themselves this expectation and almost a rite of passage to manhood to harass girls, to be seen as worthy by other boys and by other girls. It's this I am a man if I do this. And so then we carry this on into adult life where there's more to lose. We stay silent. We can be silenced with money, with an NDA. We can be silenced with our own experiences. If we felt like we're the bad kid or we're the bad person, or we have done something to invite misconduct. And I think both rape culture and purity culture, this is the, you know, the same side of the coin, if you will, because they really both elevate that you've done something wrong, whether it's something you wore or your body as a deformed man, you know, the early church fathers believed, and that a woman represents evil and a man represents purity. And so that Greco-Roman influence in the church as well has silenced women, because if a man falls, clearly it was at the hands of a woman. So then you've got that theological perspective. And really in life, as a woman, we just want to get by. We just want to go to work and be with our family and thrive. And to speak up will derail our everyday understanding of ordinary. So it makes more sense. Mm. It will cost me less to stay silent. But of course, we know, we don't keep secrets. Secrets keep us, and we're tortured. We're tortured with this. And it prevents the healing necessary to really thrive in this life.
Yeah, so good. So for those of us listeners listening right now who are like really resonating with having an experience like this, I do feel like the gap can feel so wide between, okay, Tiffany's naming my experience, but I don't know how to get to the point where I do have that voice and identity. You mentioned the finding of your identity, like in by being in a biracial family and being in a primarily white culture. What has that journey been like for you to find this voice that you so clearly have, your confidence, your passion?
Yeah, honestly, it was my understanding of who Jesus was and his empowerment of women. I was in junior high when I thought to myself, okay, I maybe don't feel Indian in America, and I for sure as heck didn't feel Indian in India when I was visiting several times, but I found myself as welcomed and beloved and empowered and unleashed for goodness and human flourishing in the kingdom. So that honestly has really been the bedrock for me. And then walking that out is to see women are harmed. Half the earth will be harmed if we don't address and handle this systemically. And charity is good. Systemic justice is better. So to really look at this holistically and understand people will suffer if we don't speak up. And so I want to use my platform. I want to leverage what I've built to be able to shape this conversation and have it not be, you know, primarily white women shape this conversation. And that's not a bad thing, but I think that there's room at the table for varied voices with differing experiences.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness, for sure. Yeah. So talk to me about back to the beginning when you like gave us, like, you just laid out a ton of like truth. You mentioned your book that no one else can write called The Resistorhood, and you say a third wave feminism. Explain to me what third wave feminism means.
Yeah. So, so we know the first wave was really suffragettes. It was voting rights. And history shows us that Black women were told to stay at the end of the march, or they were uninvited to the marches. White women wanted to shape that conversation. They thought, you know, racial issues and feminine issues were not to be overlapped. And then you think of the 70s, and in fact, even this idea of sexual harassment and violence, these are relatively new terms from the late 60s or the 70s. And so this was obviously about reproductive rights, and it was about women holding power, everything from credit cards to being able to get a mortgage. Even as late as the, you know, we know in the 70s, women couldn't even ask for the divorce, that the man had to initiate it. So all these things that women wanted rights, again, in the second wave. And then here in this third wave is this intersectional understanding that women of color also want these things. Women of different socioeconomic backgrounds want these things, and not just this idea of feminism as white women to have what white men have, but the understanding of all women to have equality and to understand that they all are worthy of fair pay and good medical care and their kids to go to good schools. It's not this just white women have what white women, and that's the critique of Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, is, well, this is only speaking to white women to have what white men have. And you'd have to oppress a lot of people to do that. But for everyone to win, for everyone to have a place at the table. And that's why this has to be addressed, because, you know, an imbalance of power is going to happen everywhere, but the response to an imbalance of power is different based on somebody's skin color, based on somebody's bank account based on somebody's immigration status. So we have to be able to look at this like, no, every woman deserves balanced power. And honestly, you look at any outcomes of when women are in power, not just one woman performatively, but women equally in power, safer cities are designed, the GDP goes up in any country that happens. There's less quick to the throttle decisions made. CEOs are less likely to make rash decisions when women are on the board. I mean, you have all this evidence that not that just women will thrive, everyone will thrive in balanced power.
Mm. Yeah. What do you say to that little part that I find sometimes prevalent, which is like, well, now you're oppressing white men. Like, now everyone's against my sons. What is your response to that? This is called Let's Be Real. So feel free to answer fully if you'd like.
Oh, yeah. It's victim, perpetrator, switch. It's called the Darbo method. I'm sure you're familiar with it, where they switch roles. They, instead of seeing themselves as the abusers of power and perpetrators of this issue, they see themselves as the victims of it. And really, if you unpack that, the thinking is it's dangerous for women to have power because look what they'll do to us. As if there's some finite amount of power or pie to go around and that they have a lot to lose. And I loved the research on this by, I believe it was Liz Plank on For the Love of Men. And she talks about, well, white men feel under attack. You know, they're going to take their guns away. They're going to take this away. They're going to take that away. And they like their big trucks and they like their big steaks and all of this. And this idea of exterior posturing of all of these things versus interior work of understanding who you are is enough. And so I think it takes a really weak man to feel under attack. I think it takes an outrageously weak man.
Well, I'm speaking of mothers at this point. Like,
oh, okay.
White mothers who are like, but what about my boys? It happens. It's like, okay. But this is, and obviously I'm raising white boys. But I would love to just like, when you hear that, or have you not heard that? Like, it's kind of like, well,
maybe nobody's been brave enough to ask me that.
No, I'm like, come on, girl, tell me what you think. I mean, it's like, kind of like, well, now, you know what it is? I think you've actually touched on it. To me, it represents a scarcity mindset.
Right.
It's a scarcity. There's going to be not enough positions, not enough power, not enough leadership, not enough jobs. So it kind of does to me touch on what you said, which is like that. The other side of like, wait a second. Do you live in this idea that there's like this very small pie and we can only have so much of it? But I just find it a fascinating topic. Like,
Somebody a few years ago said, man, it's just so hard to raise little white boys in this day and age with all of the racism and all of this and that going on. And as a mother of my oldest son is black, my youngest son is mixed, I'm Indian, my husband's white. And I just remember thinking, you are not constantly having to affirm your son's identity, that it's okay to be black, that it's okay to be an immigrant, that it's okay. You still matter. You still deserve goodness. I doubt that you're wiping the tears of your child. I'm sorry, this is so intense, but I doubt that you're wiping the tears of your child because he's not white, because he doesn't see himself represented in culture as the good guy, as the overcomer. Mm. And so I would say for mothers of white sons who might be listening today, I come to you in peace. I am a friend. I speak fluent white, girl. We're all in this together.
Well, you're married to a white man.
I'm married to a white man. Yes.
He was a white boy. Right.
Yes, he was a white boy. And I would just say, what an opportunity to raise allies. What an opportunity to raise empathetic man. What an opportunity. Your son is likely going to have more privilege without having to work as hard as a black man, an Arab man, an Asian man, a Latin man. He's likely going to have a little bit more opportunity than that. And you can kind of feel like, no, affirmative action, everything's going to somebody else. And in reality, he's likely by his name, his last name, his height, his skin tone, his blue eyes, his green eyes, and his brown and blonde hair, he's likely going to have more opportunity. And so raising empathetic men to help advocate for others to have equal opportunity, advocate for others mm-hmm. to have a place at the table. What would it look like to sacrifice a little bit of your pie to see how others could thrive? I think mm-hmm. you have an incredible yeah. opportunity well, that's, as a mother of a white man. I'm so excited to see how you're going to raise in this generation men who not only empower other men and men of color and women of color.
That's beautifully said, Tiffany. I have nothing to add. Beautifully said. Like just to see it as an opportunity, to see it as an engaging opportunity. There is a part of me that my heart goes out to every kind of people group, because at the end of the day, we all have struggles we have to overcome. There's always something, right. you know,
that's
it's,
right.
I'm like, yeah, I sometimes look at my boys and I'm like, it's hard to be a guy. Like there's yeah. It's hard. You're not allowed to be connected to your emotions. You don't know how to process your story. There's this huge stigma around therapy. Like that's hard. And then I look at my girl and I'm like, it's hard to be a girl. Like it's just, it's hard to live in an appearance driven culture. I look at my friends, women of color. I'm like, that's hard. Like we all have that, right? We don't have it in equal measure based on our society, but we have it. And if we can get in touch with that empathy side of like, how do I see this as an opportunity truly to be part of something that can be different than it has been in the past? That would be my hope and invitation for all of us together as well.
Yeah. And just as you said, that empathy, it's not, hey, they have hard stuff. Oh, I've got even harder. Or I've got hard stuff too. It's not negating that you have anything mm-hmm. hard, but it's saying, how can I use my place in the world to advocate for others, even though I'm still going through something? It's this both and.
I love that. Love that. So Tiffany, I'm going to take us from here up into, I always ask a few questions that are a little bit lighter on our way out of our interview. But before I do that, what's next for you? How, you know, I know what it's like to write a book. You're like deep in it for 2 years. You finally launch your baby into the world. And how is it shaping kind of what's next for you?
Yeah. Oh gosh. What a lighter question, but harder question too. honestly, after my research for this book, I think, I enjoyed the research portion more than I even like to admit. I think that's probably my favorite part. And just the mm-hmm. writing portion, I would say, I'm dreaming of going back to school. I'm in my mid-30s. I've got gas in the tank. I'd love to pursue, you know, actually, this is maybe way too honest. I can't believe I'm telling you this. I was filming my book trailer about a month ago and I was on my flight to come back home. I was filmed in LA and I was sitting and I'm like, okay, be 45 in 10 years. Where do I see myself? And I was able to spit out so quickly. Oh, I'd love to work for the UN or I'd love to work for UNICEF or IJM or, and it just came out of me before even like thinking. And I'm like, okay, let's go get your master's in international development. What is it going to take to get there? I'm kind of like, don't call it a midlife crisis, but let's kind of call it a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I've written 5 books in the past 3 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, as much as I want another 50,000 book contract, I think I'm just going to take 5.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to take 5 and just kind of pivot. And I think COVID's, you know, changed a lot of that for all of us. I'd be traveling and speaking twice a month and. Yeah. I have a women's ministry here in the Seattle area. We serve about 500-600 women a year where we gather and we do beautiful food and wine and I teach and it's so lovely. And that takes quite a lot when it's in session, but because COVID, we haven't met for a year. And that was taking 15-20 hours a week. So, life's been turned on its head. So it's time to dream again for me. It's time to really be like, okay, where do I see myself next? I've spent, well over a decade in full-time ministry and kind of realizing, you know what, let's take these skills and capabilities and understanding and knowledge and wisdom to a new place and space.
Oh my goodness. Let's not call it a midlife crisis. Let's call it a midlife opportunity.
Okay. Girl, it was a whole thing. I need to start taking ashwagandha. I'm embracing my grays. I'm kind of digging it. I think if you have good skin, gray actually looks kind of cool, whatever. It's fine. So I'm like, we're ready.
You're coming into your eldership and it's beautiful to be an elder because it's like, I'm here with wisdom and I know who I am.
I know.
And I'm okay with who you are. And if you don't if you don't need who I am, that's fine. It doesn't bother me. I'm still going to go after it. And I just think that you're a living picture. Not that, I mean, I love ministry. Actually, I just finished an interview with another friend who's transitioned out of ministry. And I'm like, there is a really deceptive lie that somehow vocational ministry is more important than, even though we preach all the time, like go be, you know, light in your workplace. But I think that as our world gets darker, which I think it is getting as the darkness of sin, like as the world gets darker, we are going to need brighter light. And it's definitely to me going to happen in the flourishing of the community. It's not going to happen in the cloister of the church, even though I'm called to that work. Like it's, so I'm like, I can't wait to, can't wait to hear about your first UN appointment.
Amen. I received that in the name of Jesus Christ. When we think of contributing to human flourishing, you're right. If you grew up in church culture, there's that just little seed that got planted and sadly was watered to believe that this was supreme. And in reality, we're all contributing equally. And so with my past work all being research and understanding of women's issues, I'm like, we got to take this show on the road. It's one thing to write about good. It's another thing to go help address
it. Absolutely. Yeah. Gosh, this is so great. I can just like already think of people that I know listen to this podcast who needed to hear what you had to say today. Oh. Okay. So this is our actual light question.
I'm ready. Because that was
light question. What is your favorite product that you are loving right now?
Just one.
Just what's the first one that came to mind? I'm going to give you, you can go one, you pick one of your choice and then tell us about something that's a productivity type thing that you love. Any product. Yes. One. Come on.
Number one, I love Glossier's bubble wrap. It can be used on your eyes and your lips. Very affordable, high performing, life changer. Like I use it.
In the show notes, everyone. I'll put it there for you.
I just changed people's
Glossier's
lives.
Glossier's bubble wrap.
Send me your testimonies. I'll be there to celebrate.
All shades? Is it like all shades?
No, it's an eye cream.
Oh, it's an eye cream.
Yeah.
For wrinkles?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Send it. Girl.
Oh, yes.
High performing.
I need it.
$30 price point. It's the good stuff. I'm like, girl, I'm not going to go buy La Mer. No, who has got $200 to go get eye cream, right? Like I'll get the
Target for like a thing that's like the size of a postage stamp. Yes.
Right. Exactly. So bubble wrap. So it kind of just, it's magic. It's my favorite product. So that would be absolute favorite product. Secondly, favorite product. This is so cliche coffee drinker, but I really love Vital Proteins has marine collagen because the bovine and the, you know, everybody's into collagen, putting collagen in their coffee, and the bovine one can kind of make, I have a pretty oily skin. So and it can kind of overproduce acne. And so I found this marine one. Okay, real talk. So there was this guy at the Whole Foods and he was clearly in his 70s to 80s and he had perfect skin and that was in his cart. So I went and got myself some. And it is the marine one. It is from fish bones.
I am not going to believe that this is your genetics. I am going to believe that it is the marine collagen. I choose to claim that. It is the marine collagen.
And I'm getting 11 grams of protein in my morning coffee and I can't taste a thing. So that can't live without it.
I have to do this. I have to get on this train.
Marine,
okay.
Don't go to Costco and get the bovine one. Don't do that. You're going to have to just bite the bullet and get the marine one.
At Whole Foods. Okay. Glossier bubble wrap, marine collagen. What's your favorite productivity app? Like to help you do your work, anything, product or app that you like to use?
I'm sure you've heard this a million times, but Asana, it's my everyday task manager. I can assign things to my, you know, assistant sometimes. It's just useful, helpful, quick, even like social media scheduling. I can attach the image I want, you know, bulk schedule. And then all I have to do is upload with the captions. It just makes life easy.
I love it. No, you're the first one who said Asana. Their productivity app was called Better Than Asana. Like that was their, I can't remember the name of it right now. But anyway, I love a good rec because sometimes people are like, help me get connected to the way to manage my life. So Asana
and their
it
app
is awesome.
just as user-friendly as the desktop cloud version.
Perfect. You're converting me actually right now. I'm like, wait a second. I'm a productivity junkie.
And even
I know that's probably, I'm like, wait a second.
Yeah,
I need to get on that. Okay. All right, Tiffany, it has been amazing. Thank you for all of the knowledge you have dropped on us and the way that you've enlightened us around these issues. You guys, pick up Tiffany's book, Pray Tell. great book you're going to love, Get Connected. We'll drop her Instagram handle for you as well so that we can keep up with your life. Like, we're all cheering you on to grad school now at this point.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the Let's Be Real podcast. If you have a question for the show, you can send it to me at Nicole@NicoleEunice.com. And hey, if you're enjoying this, we'd love for you to like, subscribe, share it with your friends, pass it on, shout it from the rooftops, whatever you feel like doing, because the reality is, let's get as many people getting real as possible. Talk to you soon.